Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin. A few months back, we featured two podcast interviews with Professor Rodney Stark, the co-founder of Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, discussing his most recent book, The Triumph of Christianity. The sheer challenge of tackling the history of Christianity from the early church until present day necessitated more than one episode, and I promised listeners that we would break that work down into three parts. Well, so far we have done two podcasts, with the first being a look at the historical context of Christianity's birth up until the conversion of Constantine. The second interview took us from Constantine up to the Protestant Reformation. Today, I make good on my promise to bring you the third part of our interview that takes us from the Reformation up to present time, with a bit of discussion as to whether or not Christianity is in decline in our contemporary era. As is our standard operating practice, we will link to these earlier podcasts as well as many of Professor Stark's books, including the one we focus on today. And if you do like what you hear, and you find these interviews to be a valuable resource, please share them with your friends, family, students, colleagues, and fellow parishioners. They are also a great resource for homeschoolers and a free gift to you, courtesy of the good folks at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, who sponsors our podcast. Rod, welcome back once again to Research on Religion.
Well, I'm delighted to be here.
Well, good. All right. Hey, let's get right down to brass tacks, and let's go ahead and start off where we left off last time, which was the Protestant Reformation. Now, one of the assertions that you made in your book, which I have found to be a very valuable way to think of that historical era, is that the Protestant Reformation was not so much of a reform of the Christian church as it was a breakaway sect that in turn prompted a later Reformation within the Roman church. And that later Reformation in the Roman church we often call the Counter-Reformation. Could you explain this perspective to our listeners?
Well, sure. What really goes on historically is there were many, many efforts to reform the Catholic Church within the Church. They failed, although there was this period around the time of the Crusades when, in fact, most of the popes had been monks, and they were very much into reforming the Church. But that era ended, and you had one after another failed attempt. And so in a certain sense, if you were going to change the church, reform the church, you were going to be pushed into being a breakaway movement, whether you wanted to be or not. And I think it's pretty clear that that Luther's original intention was not to break away. But he did. And in the long run, he reformed the church. And I don't mean because of the Lutheran church. I mean he reformed the Roman Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of, we're going to talk about what goes on in the Catholic Church in response to the Protestant Reformation, and there are big changes that occur within the Catholic Church at that point. But let's stick with the Protestant Reformation. Now, a lot of historians have considered the Reformation to be to have materialist roots. And so, if we're talking about what caused this thing, a lot of folks focus on changes within the material economy, how we produce goods, services, and things like that. But you argue that it was really a religious movement, first and foremost. So tell us a little bit about why you disagree with these other historians.
Well, you start with the Marxists, for example, who claim that it was a movement of the masses. But the masses weren't involved. It's pretty obvious that the Reformation had very little effect on most of the people, say, in Germany. It affected the upper middle class primarily, and that was sufficient to carry it through. But the people were pretty much outside the church, whether it was of the Roman Catholic Church or subsequently the Lutheran Church. There's an enormous amount of reports from visitations by Lutheran clergy reporting back to Luther and saying, hey, nobody goes to church. And at the end of his life, Luther says, you know, it's a failure in terms of reaching the people.
Mm-hmm. And that's a rather interesting perspective, because most people also assert that religiosity is something that occurs amongst the lower classes, because the educated upper classes, of course, don't believe all this silly nonsense.
Quite the reverse.
It's quite the reverse.
Yeah.
Now, the church, throughout its history, experienced a number of different schismatic movements ever since the beginning of its history. And you think of more famous cases such as Jan Hus or Wycliffe or a few others like that. But what made this one different? Why did this one stick?
Because Luther was lucky in the fact that there were all kinds of political reasons for the German princes to be very alienated from the Pope and from the Catholic Church, and consequently they defended him. Otherwise, he would have gone to the stake like everybody else. But the fact is, the German princes rallied around and in effect used Luther as a license to cease, for example, sending all kinds of money to Rome. And it was the political good fortune of Luther to be in the right place.
And so, and that's a period of time too. He's in the right place at the right time. He gets a lot of protection from these princes, various nobility that protect him. And he's relatively far away from the Vatican, from Rome at this point in time too. So that just physically removes him a little bit from this. But how did the movement by Luther spread? And then also concurrently by Calvin, because Calvin becomes a major player in this as well. I mean, once Luther starts the ball rolling, Calvin jumps on this, you have Zwingli and a few others, and everything just starts moving. So how did the Protestant Reformation spread throughout Europe at a time when transportation wasn't the greatest, especially considered compared to contemporary times?
Well, there are two major factors. One of them was, of course, the printing press had come along, and this was probably the first major social movement that was able to utilize all kinds of printed pamphlets and flyers and some of the sales figures on, you know, 2- and 4-page pamphlets written by Luther, and they'd sell 300,000 copies in a couple of months. You know, instead of hauling pamphlets, you know, in wagons from one city to another, they'd only need to take one because there was a printer in the other city. And the printers loved Luther's stuff because it sold. It led to a very false conception, by the way, that the printers had all been Lutherans who supported Luther. It turns out they weren't. What they were is guys who printed stuff that sold.
Yeah, that would make sense. They probably looked at this and they say, hey, people, let's give it a try. People want it. And or somebody coming from another village and town says, hey, you know, people are really wanting this. You're going to want to sell this. One of the other observations, too, that this spreads by the pamphlets and printers reemphasizes a point that you made earlier, that this was an upper class religious rebellion, in that not a whole lot of people could read at this time. So the ones who are buying these pamphlets are, number one, those who have the money to do it and disposable income, and number two, those people who can actually read, which
right,
required education.
The readers were the people with money.
Mm-hmm.
The interesting thing, the second major factor in the spread of the, you know, the Reformation was college students. There were a number of universities that went over to Luther, and their students went home and preached the Reformation when they got there. Now, there were a lot of good, solid Catholic universities, and where their students went home, it turns out the Reformation didn't happen. There's a wonderful study by Steve Fath and another fellow that chart all of this. They've got a sample of, I don't know, something like 200 towns. And they know where the students went to school. It's amazing. German, European universities probably are as well as Drummond, but they never destroy any records. So you can reconstruct who took Luther's classes, for example. You can find out where all the students at Wittenberg came from. What were their hometowns? And it's remarkable because you can plot the changing of towns on the basis of where their students went to college.
Yeah, we did interview Steve Pfaff on one of our very first interviews here, and we'll go ahead and link back to that.
Scholar.
He is a great scholar, a great colleague. He's at University of Washington with me, so we'll link back to that. And I've also got a promise from him that he's going to be coming back on our show in a couple weeks, so look out for Steve Pfaff. One of the other things that's emphasized, too, so we got pamphlets, we got printers, we got professors, we have students. The other issue is these free cities, which were relatively unique in world history at this point in time. So how did they play a role?
Well, there were all of these cities that had managed at this point to get independent of the local nobility and answerable only to the national, you know, the king or whatever. And this gave them an enormous amount of freedom because the king only cared if they sent in their tax money. He was smart enough not to try to administer all of these cities. So you got something called the Free Cities. There were about 70 or 80 of them spread along the German-French border for the most part. And they were free to do whatever they felt like doing in terms of the Reformation. And overwhelmingly, they voted to go, to become Lutheran. There were a number of other cities like them in the area that were not free cities, but in fact were ruled by a prince bishop or whatever, and they didn't. They didn't go in the Reformation. So where the kind of the local shopkeepers and intellectuals and whatnot wanted to become Lutheran, they did. And where there was more control on them, they didn't.
Now, we talked a little bit about that earlier. You talked about the political reasons that a number of German princes did rally around the folks, the students, the professors, the folks who were promoting Protestantism or Lutheran's writings and sending them around at this point in time. One of the things that I noted, too, in reading about the history of the Protestant Reformation is for the first decade or two, it really was this bottom-up movement. It was a grassroots movement of people saying, wow, Lutheran's got some great ideas. Oh, this guy Calvin, he has some really interesting things too. So people with that fervency. But later on, this starts to change, and you start to see political authorities, princes, nobility, kings, deciding just to pick up Protestantism for other reasons. What's going on there?
Well, it's a very ironic thing. Where the Catholic Church was strongest, had the most authority vis-a-vis the local prince or whoever, those areas were the most likely to turn Protestant. Where the Catholic Church was weak relative to the local nobility, they tended to stay Catholic. And what this has to do with is the self-interest of the nobility. In Southern Europe, for example, in many places, like in France and Spain, the crown had already dealt with the Pope in ways that gave the power to the crown and took it away from the Pope. That is to say, the right to name bishops, for example. In France, the king could name all the bishops. In Spain, the king could name all the bishops. This wasn't true in the north. This wasn't true in Scandinavia and in most of the German principalities. So where the church had the power and was very, very wealthy and had all this land and whatever, there was a real motive for the local prince to turn Lutheran and seize all the church land and get rid of having the bishop tell him anything. In Southern Europe, there was no motive to dump the church because you already had all the power. And if you wanted church money, you could have it. And there were enormous gains by the crowns in places like Sweden and whatnot from expropriating the church. Of course, Henry VIII was one of the classic examples. I mean, you know, he seized huge wealth by simply ceasing to be Catholic.
Yeah, and his Reformation, too, wasn't necessarily based upon Protestant ideas.
As a matter of fact, he was given to burning Lutherans.
Yeah. Yeah, no, the separation of his from the Vatican for himself, I mean, basically makes the Church of England look like the Catholic Church without the Pope, essentially.
That's right, and the fact of the matter is that, you know, while it seems very superficial and almost even libelous to say it, the fact is that was a divorce church.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It is kind of interesting that you have this irony that where the church was the strongest in Northern Europe, there was this temptation to expropriate land and to take all the wealth now. It's interesting because, again, this starts as a grassroots movement. But then as soon as these princes say, hey, there's something to this Luther thing, it's sticking around, a decade or two later, you say, let's just go ahead and declare my territory to be Protestant, and we'll sever ties with Rome. We basically end any debts that we have with Rome at this point in time. We take a lot of their wealth and land. And the consequence of this, too, for the religiosity of the masses was that they were just told, hey, today you're Protestant. Yesterday you were Catholic, and today you're Protestant. So they didn't really necessarily, the bulk of the population didn't really necessarily get imbued with Protestant theology, did they?
It had no impact on them since they didn't go to church anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, the notion of medieval piety is, in fact, a false notion. Church attendance was abysmal. Heck, for most of the medieval period, in an era when almost everybody lived in a rural area, there weren't any rural churches.
Mm-hmm.
Or the only churches were out there were little chapels maintained by the local lord, and nobody was invited except his family and maybe a few retainers. And how are people going to go to church when there aren't any?
Yeah, and if they don't hear that,
the matter is the masses. If you want to use that old Marxist phrase, the masses were outside the church, and it isn't even clear that subsequently whether you wanted them to come to church, because where and then where they were forced to attend church, they misbehaved. I mean, there are all these stories about, you know, people coming into church half drunk and going to sleep immediately. And, you know, bringing their dogs, and the dogs barked, and it was awful. And you know, we don't have to sit here and make this up, because there are all these written reports from observers, official observers who went out and looked at the churches and coming back and are saying, this is appalling what's going on out here. And it's quite amazing.
I do want to hold that point at bay for a little bit, but it is an important one, because when we talk later about the secularization of Europe, there's this image that religiosity has declined precipitously. But what you're just telling us here is that, you know, for the bulk of the population, they weren't that religious. They're still hanging on a number of pagan traditions or beliefs.
Their religion was magic.
Yeah. And that doesn't change very much over the course of centuries. So to see this precipitous drop from the holy high eras when everybody was very churchly is somewhat mythical.
You know, after the cathedrals arrived, you've got all these letters being written by bishops saying, you've got to stop having all these animal sales and things in the cathedral, and please put the baptismal font back in the front of the church. And, you know, well, why aren't you holding Mass on Sunday?
Right. Let's go ahead and talk about the consequences of the Protestant Reformation as we're starting to think forward about what this is and bringing up to present time. And I want to look at this from two different angles. One, obviously, is being how Protestantism changed the nature of Christianity, but let's set that aside for a minute. There's the Roman Catholic side of things, because one could imagine that the Vatican's going to be none too happy with Martin Luther and John Calvin and others breaking away from the church. The Catholic Church did not sit idly by and allow this challenge to their spiritual hegemony within Europe. So how did the Catholic Church react to all this?
Well, first, let's backtrack a little bit into something we talked about on the last podcast.
Okay.
The two churches. This started way back, there basically was the monastic movement on the one hand, and a bunch of pretty worldly secular priests on the other hand. And the secular priests for most of the church's history had the power. Some of them were very good people, and some of them were very corrupt people. But the monastic aspect end of the Church of Piety, tried again and again and again to reform the church, and for a brief period in the 11th century, they were in power, and the church was, in fact, greatly changed. And then it all slipped back. What happens with the Protestant Reformation is finally there was such an enormous challenge to the church that the Church of Piety won. They took over and were able at this point to impose all of the reforms that they had been trying to push for 1,000 years. The enforcement of celibacy, the production of a scripture in the local languages. As a result, they were able to establish for the first time seminaries. You know, the fact of the matter is, most priests in medieval times were trained as apprentices, not by seminaries. Couldn't speak any Latin, couldn't read any Latin. A lot of them faked their way through the mass, just mumbling nonsense syllables, it turns out. Suddenly there were seminaries, priests were educated, the church was enormously reformed and changed and became the church that we know now, which is a very respectable institution.
Yeah, and one of the things that this brings up is that competition, when it presents itself, really forces both sides of the equation to become better. It has a positive sum aspect to it. And there's a great deal of talk within this perspective known as the economics of religion, how spiritual diversity or denominational diversity can make a religious landscape much more vigorous, that a lot of people participate much more. And people have come at this by saying, well, if you run the regression this way and you massage the data this way or that way, it doesn't necessarily look that way. There's still a lot of people that think you need to have one monolithic faith in order for things to work out. But this is a very, very clear example of how competition, namely Martin Luther, John Calvin, come by and say, hey, you guys are really screwing up. And somebody there at the top of the Vatican says, you know what, maybe we do have to change things. They call together the Council of Trent in the 1550s, and they start making wholesale changes in response, in direct response to this.
Right. Now, some of these changes had in fact been attempted again and again and again within the confines of the church, but they either failed to get the support they needed, or they got through but didn't last. Finally, they lasted. You really have a totally changed church, the Church of Piety, won over the Church of Power, and you know ever since we've had popes that there's no question about their personal piety. Well, in medieval times, there were plenty of popes who clearly weren't pious. Just some dreadful scandals. That doesn't happen anymore. And in an important sense, it was Luther's success that reformed the church and made it probably, I suppose you could say in retrospect, the church that he wanted. Because after all, in the beginning, he was a very, very committed Catholic.
Yeah, no, that is one of the interesting ironies of history. The other thing that's interesting here too is you can see how all of this takes shape, because at the time of the Reformation, the Spanish and Portuguese monarchs were actually settling what becomes Latin America here, and there's a nice little natural experiment, because the ability for Protestants to get over to that territory is cut off by the fact that there's a large ocean there. And it's very interesting to see that the church within Latin America for several hundred years really takes a looks very much like the Church of Power pre-Reformation. And it took until the early 1900s when you do see Protestants starting to come in until they actually face the same thing, saying, oh my gosh, we have to reform. Maybe we should make our masses not in Latin, but we should produce Bibles in the vernacular, even let Bibles in so that people can read them and such.
Yeah, well, the enormous growth of Protestantism in Latin America, one of its major effects has been to reform and greatly strengthen the Catholic Church.
Uh-huh.
That may seem an irony, but the fact is that Catholics in Latin America never went to church at the level they now go to church.
Right.
And that's because the church got busy and started working hard because the Protestants were scaring them.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's very clear evidence to this, even by the mouth of the Pope and the bishops themselves. They say, you know, the reason why we need to get better, we need to, care about the individuals at the poorest levels of society is because, the Protestants are doing a better job than we are.
That's right.
And so we got a big kick in the pants. Let me go ahead and talk about some of the downsides of the Counter-Reformation that occurred. Now, again, the positive sides was the church started to take its mission, its spiritual mission, very seriously, started to really engage populations and make the populations much more spiritually connected to their institution. But you do mention a few downsides to the Counter-Reformation in relation to both business and to university education. So give us a sense for what's going on there.
Somehow, there was a backsliding. The medieval church had reformed its views on business, for example, to be very favorable. The Counter-Reformation church became much less favorable to commerce. It made it appear, as a matter of fact, that the rise of industrialism was purely a Protestant effect, which it wasn't, but the attitude of the church was such that it could easily be sold that this was, the Protestant ethic and all those sorts of things, which really weren't so. But it had a negative effect on Catholic intellectual life in that there was a tendency to crack down on science that had not been true. The great scientific revolution, so-called, 16th, 17th centuries, were as Catholic as they were Protestant. But Catholic universities in the 19th century were took a backward view on some of these things. And there was a way in which Catholic schools they had been tremendous intellectual places in, say, 1600, 1700, but in 1850 they weren't.
Mm-hmm.
And even in my lifetime, when I was a little kid, places like Notre Dame and whatnot were not known for their intellectual quality, but for their football teams. Notre Dame is now a fine school. This all changed. But for a while, the Counter-Reformation had some negative effects on intellectual freedom.
It does, and it paints the history of the church, too, in a different way, because intellectuals who now start to write histories in the 1700s and 1800s take a very dim view of the Catholic Church and oftentimes report that it was anti-scientific the whole time. And it really wasn't. I mean, some of the great universities, University of Bologna, the University of Paris, were Catholic institutions that really start the whole scientific ball rolling. And the same, as you mentioned, the same thing with commerce. And that's something that I learned from this book too. And when I think back on this, I say, okay, the free cities where there was a great deal of commerce on the German and French borders were the ones where there was a lot of entrepreneurism that was going on right there. And they become Protestant. And the Catholic Church can only look at this and say, oh, that can't be a good thing. So we just are very angry at those folks that turned away from our church. And it takes on a very anti-capitalist flavor that, I mean, I think in many ways it's still reflected within Catholic social teaching and social thought up through present time, you know, from Pius IX, you know, about 100 years ago or so, up to current times, in favor of more state-controlled economies.
You know, one of the great surprises of history is that in the 10th and 11th and 12th century, you've got all these men who've taken vows of poverty,
mm-hmm.
who are rethinking the whole Christian view of commerce and coming up with positive views that, you know, St. Augustine on, these people were, you know, even going back that far, the Christian view of commerce was favorable and very different from, say, that of Islam or even the pagan religions.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, somehow, all of that got lost in the aftermath of the Reformation, which made it look as if the church was anti-business, because in a sense it was at that point.
Yeah, yeah.
But historically, it had certainly not been.
Now, one of the other things that often comes up in terms of the Counter-Reformation is that the issue of the Inquisition, or more specifically, the
right.
Spanish Inquisition. And a lot of Protestant historians later on, and a lot of Enlightenment or secularist historians later on, point to the Spanish Inquisition as the Catholic Church behaving very badly to this. And it basically gives the church a poor reputation, which in turn, they paint a brush over all religious institutions, saying, see, this is what happens when you have religious institutions. You get a very intolerant church that tortures peoples and kills witches at the drop of a hat and that. But you provide a whole chapter in your book on this. And again, this is one of these very valuable chapters. I read through this, and I remember reading other histories about the Spanish Inquisition, and I read yours, and I'm going, oh, yeah, you know, those other things don't make sense, what other people were saying. This kind of makes sense in the big history of the thing. So let's work our way through that. What is the typical image that historians have painted over the last 200-300 years of the Spanish Inquisition?
It's an amazing story, because it's a great falsehood, a great libel. The fact of the matter is the Catholic, particularly the Spanish Inquisition, was a force for moderation and tolerance. Astounding as that may seem, rather than having been the backbone, say, of the witchcraft craze that swept over Europe, the Catholic Inquisition in Italy and Spain not only played no role in that, they played a major role in ending it. And during its craziest time, it was not going on in Italy and Spain. The most remarkable thing is the Spanish Inquisition did have some people executed, hanged, as a matter of fact, out of concern for witchcraft. But ironically, these were people that were condemned for having burned witches. The Catholic Inquisition had no tolerance for that. It didn't believe. It believed that witchcraft was possible, but it also was reporting again and again, we've gone up here and investigated, and there aren't any witches here. What's so remarkable is that in the very beginning, see, the witchcraft trials were really over people practicing magic. And when the Catholic Inquisition encountered some of the first people who were accused of witchcraft, they listened to them and discovered they had no notion that they were doing anything wrong. They were using church magic that they weren't authorized to practice, in effect, but that they weren't, in fact, having anything to do with Satan. As a matter of fact, so they made up this notion of unintentionally invoking evil spirits. And that led everybody off. I mean, you said 10 Hail Marys and that you were sorry, and that was the end of it.
Yeah.
And consequently, they wrote some enormous attacks on the whole notion of witchcraft. And as those spread over Europe, the witchcraft crazes ended. Now, how do we know all of this? Is, you know, is Stark making this up? What happened is about 30 years ago, a bunch of scholars, many of them not Catholics, were given access to an archive that included every major trial held by the Spanish Inquisition over a period of 150 years. And there are about 50,000 of these trials documented in great detail. And I mean, it would take half a career even to read this whole archive. So these guys, in fact, computerized it. And we know very well about who was accused of what, for what, in what proportion, and what happened to them. And it turns out that about 10 people a year in Spain were turned over to the civil authorities for execution. 10 a year. This is a time when, in the, most of Europe, even tiny minor crimes got you hanged. And yet the Spanish Inquisition is not hanging people. It's astonishing.
Yeah, there's an interesting logic to all of this, too. And when you, you think through it and you, you go read some of these more updated accounts of what really went on during the Spanish Inquisition, it makes sense because, okay, there's some people that might be invoking Satan. Those are the people who really get in a lot of trouble. Most other people, since there are not doctors around, they're practicing magic just to cure people. And it's just kind of the thing that goes on at the times. The church says, well, you know, be a little bit more careful with that. But the church is also very careful because it doesn't like these crazes going on in its own community. I mean, if you're a parish priest or a bishop within a diocese and you see everybody accusing everybody else of witches and bringing them to the church and say, hang them, hang them, hang them, you have social chaos, and that's not going to be very good for the economy of the local region. It's not going to be very good for your institution. So it doesn't make sense to have a witch craze.
No, of course it doesn't make sense. And also, these guys, you know, one of the real problems was that there was church magic and non-church magic. All magic works some of the time. And unfortunately, Christian theologians are really hooked on rationality. They don't like unexplained things. Where, so instead of in most societies, magic, so, you know, so you say that and something happens and fine. The Christians were determined to know why it worked. Now, church magic, they knew why it worked. That's because God and Jesus and the various saints made it work. Well, what's making non-church magic? I mean, because sometimes, you know, these people say they're little things over the person and he's healed. Why did that work?
Mm-hmm.
Well, since it wasn't God, who could be doing it? And the answer was Satan. So it was the enormous rationality of Christian theology that got them in all this trouble, which is a terrible irony. But the Catholic Inquisition didn't go along with it. They modified it. And they said, you know, if Satan's making it work, this poor person who did the magic didn't know that. And therefore, they're off the hook. It's astonishing. And by the way, the people who were most likely to get punished by the Inquisition were priests. There were, of course, priests who were seducing women this way and that way, using the confessional inappropriately. And they got in some pretty bad trouble for it. But it's just amazing to look over these cases and see, you know, you read the accounts written by the Protestants about the Catholic Inquisition, and you think that they're having, you know, 300 people burned every weekend.
Right.
Instead of, you know, 10 people hanged a year in a whole country. You know, it was part of the... The English and the Spanish were at war for a couple hundred years, and this, and then of course the Protestants hating the Catholics and whatnot, and that's where it came from.
Yeah, it's important to really recognize where the writing on this stuff initially comes from, and we think, scholars are all objective in their viewpoints here. But yeah, if you're a Protestant scholar in Northern Europe and you're involved in the Hundred Years' War, and you need to knock those Spanish down a notch or two because they're the enemies.
Yeah, well, the fact of the matter is, as you and I well know, scholars and intellectuals aren't particularly objective.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Lord knows there's more nonsense than anyone cares to admit going on in our profession.
That is the case. I got to save that for a whole different podcast because that could open a whole new realm of prospects that we don't have quite time for here. But I do want to bring it back around to Protestantism. And in terms of the consequences of the Reformation for Protestantism in Europe and also in America. Now, there's an interesting historical tension in the legacy of Protestantism in Europe. On the one hand, given the religious diversity that it ushers in, one would expect that's going to create a very intense spiritual landscape in Northern Europe as different churches challenge and inspire one another, because it's not just necessarily a negative sum competition, it could be a positive sum competition here. And this really is the legacy that Protestant had on Catholicism, as we just discussed. Alternatively, it turns out that Northern Europe is where religion seemingly goes to die over the next several centuries, giving rise to this whole host of theories about secularization and the inevitable godless society. What occurs in Northern Europe, say, starting in the 1700s, 1800s, that leads to this patina of secularization that we think is going on there?
Well, it's what didn't occur.
Mm-hmm.
There never was a great campaign to convert the masses, if you will. In the early days of the church, it was an enormously conversionist movement. I mean, you start out with 12 people in Israel, and pretty soon you've got the whole Roman Empire. And that only happened because, enormous numbers of people were converted to the faith, and were committed, and the Christian Church was very, very active. Then, as it starts after the fall of Rome, as it starts moving slowly north, it took centuries for Christianity really to penetrate Northern Europe. I mean, we're talking 1100, 1200 for the Scandinavian nations. And the conversion was as follows. You baptize the king and son of the court, and you're satisfied with that because it means that you're the official church. No other church is permitted, and the tithes flow. But nobody bothered to go out and see Ole and Aunts and make Christians out of them.
Yeah.
And Northern Europe was always much, much less Christianized than Southern Europe. And nothing has changed. Mm-hmm. That is to say, the Protestant monopoly churches that replaced the Catholic Church were as lazy as can be.
Mm-hmm.
They passed a law and say everybody in Sweden is a member of the Lutheran Church. But what does that matter? I mean, that's a legal definition. It has nothing to do with what the people are doing.
Mm-hmm.
And for the most part, Scandinavians didn't really become good Lutherans until they came to the United States.
And that brings up the second current, because one of the interesting things that the Protestant Reformation unleashes is the possibility that you can break away from the official church at the time, and that there's essentially no major consequences. I mean, Luther basically, for Protestants, takes the issue of excommunication off the table. And so it does create, especially amongst very spiritually minded reformers, the possibility that says, okay, now we've become Lutherans, but man, the Lutheran church is just as corrupt as the Catholic church was that we were rebelling against. So now let's create a different movement. And you see, you know, over the course of the next couple hundred years, all these different schismatic movements are able to get more traction, in part because, you know, printing is now becoming much more common, so they're using the same tactics that they did before. But you get the Shakers, you get the Quakers, you get the Puritans, you get the Presbyterians, and every other shape of this. And it really, I mean, you see those constant movements taking hold within various pockets of Europe, but then they make their way over to the New World at a certain point in time. And this is, for me, this is a really interesting part of the Christian history, because the New World, especially we're talking here, the British colonies and the Americas, really opened the door for the possibility of Protestantism to flourish the way that it was meant to, I think, in the early 1500s. So let's talk a little bit about that. The United States, why does the United States become an exceptional case in terms of being much more religious than Northern Europe is?
Competition.
Mm-hmm. So explain that.
If you have an established church, which you have all over Northern Europe, it doesn't have to work. It's a lazy church. And yes, you get some of these groups like the Puritans and whatnot coming along, and they are able to activate some people. But the great millstone hanging around religious reform is still the state church that quote everybody by law belongs to, and that everybody is supporting with their money, whether they want to or not, etc. But when you get to the United States, you get in a situation where there is no established religion. This is, in fact, subsequent to, at least, to the American Revolution. This is basically prohibited. And it's the various denominations are on their own for support.
Mm-hmm.
You're gonna be in business and pay it. If the preacher's going to get his salary paid, he's got to get himself a congregation.
And yeah, that is a huge point of the issue of competition. I know people think about competition as, you know, kind of like a football field, people going against one another. But the fact of where the clergy member gets their revenue really motivates how hard they're going to work.
Yeah, but the thing that's interesting is if you get in a relatively small area, a whole bunch of different clergy, each working as hard as they can to attract and hold a congregation, the net effect of that is an enormously high level of activation of the population. In other words, as each guy goes out there and succeeds in arousing some people, the total number aroused goes up.
Mm-hmm.
That isn't happening in Europe.
Yeah.
Although it's starting to.
Yeah, we'll talk about that in a second. One of the other interesting things that you write in your book, and this is also based on some of the work you did with a book that you wrote with Roger Finke, The Churching of America, is that not only does the American experiment show you the effect that not having a state church, of having religious freedom, can really open the doors for vigorous religious competition, diversity, pluralism that, again, engages the population. But the history of America itself illustrates that, because and this is when I read your earlier work with Roger Finke, I was astounded, because I had the image that, you know, the early American colonies were all very pious. 100% of the population went to church, and now, you know, fewer people, therefore, they were in the decline of Western civilization. But that's not the case. And the what happens throughout the 1600s into the 1700s into the 1800s really illustrates this point of religious freedom leading to more religious vitality. Go ahead and give us a little bit of that story.
Church membership has risen and doubled and redoubled enormously over the last 200 years,
which surprises most people.
Yeah, you know, we have a sense that our notion of colonial America is fashioned by some pictures of the Puritans gone their way to church. The fact of the matter, of course, is that the majority of people, even on the Mayflower, weren't Puritans. The best estimate we can make is that in 1776, somewhat less than 20%, maybe about 17%, of the American population actually belonged and participated in the local church. By 1800, that had risen. By 1850, you've got about a third of Americans belonging to a church. Sometime early in the 20th century, we hit the 50 mark. Today, it's about 70. That's an enormous change, and it also makes America very different from Europe. Americans simply are much more likely to belong to church and be active in religion, and that makes them more religious. It's hard to be religious purely on your own, kind of in a social vacuum. It's a social thing. And the benefits are enormous.
Well, let's talk about the benefits in a second here, but this brings up the issue of secularization theory. Because, again, when modern social science starts taking off with Weber in the 1800s and then into the early 1900s, a number of social scientists want to study religion. And they look at Europe, and that's a very modern place. And they say, well, modernity must lead to the decline of religion because that's what we have. We must have had religion back there in the 1500s. Right. And as we already noted, that it wasn't really the case amongst the popular classes, that they were not necessarily engaged. But then there's this whole thing in the United States. And as you showed here, that, you know, again, the colonial American times was a pioneer society. You had a bunch of 20-year-old males coming over. They are not necessarily the churchy kind, but as the population becomes more settled, as churches start to preach more and become more institutionalized, the actual number of people increases here. It looks like America is really the exception, and so secularization theorists are stuck trying to explain the American exception. But you kind of claim that Europe is somewhat the exception here. So give us your take on secularization theory and where we're at in that in the social sciences.
Well, the basic assumption of secularization theory is that religion is false and that people slowly will get educated and become intelligent enough to get over this nonsense. I mean, that's what we're really talking about, is that people will become enlightened. Doesn't work that way in the fact that the most educated Americans are the ones most likely to go to church. Scientists aren't the irreligious group everybody pretends they are. The unchurched people are the least affluent, least educated, the least sophisticated people in the country. Now, that drives European intellectuals nuts, but the fact remains that if you look at America, you see no prospect of the church of religion going out of business because people become enlightened. There's an interesting thing going on in Europe. I think the thing about Europe, these guys all believe that religion declined, and in fact, it never rose, and that's the big difference, and they don't seem to grasp that. But there's a marvelous little thing going on that suggests that Europe may become very religious, and that is, as everybody knows, European fertility has, you know, hit the skids. It's so low now that if it were to continue for another, say, 150 years, there won't be any Swedes in Sweden or Germans in Germany or even Italians in Italy. But while everybody notices this, they forgot to notice something else, which is those Europeans who are religious are still having kids. And you can play with these numbers and see that over the next 150 years, instead of there being no Germans in Germany or Swedes in Sweden, there just won't be irreligious Germans and irreligious Swedes. The population will have been replaced by the kids, the sons and daughters and granddaughters of the religious people, who will probably themselves be religious or much more likely to be.
Yeah, there's a tendency to.
You could have the Christianization of Europe purely as a function of differential fertility.
Yeah, that you see the same kind of trends here in the United States too, is that people who are much more religious tend to have more than two kids per family, whereas those who are more secular tend not to. And so it's just a numbers game.
The church are very much less likely to be married mm-hmm. or to have children.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about all these surveys that we hear about, the American Religious Identification Survey, that clang the alarm bells that there are now more nones, N-O-N-E-S, that people are not affiliated with religion anymore. And we also hear there's rarely a week that goes by where we don't hear some story that, well, kids are no longer going to church. They're disillusioned with the institutional church nowadays.
Oh, that's tiresome. Many years ago, I published a little table showing that the younger people didn't go to church nearly as much as the middle-aged and the older people. And I pointed out that that could be for two reasons possible. One would be that people were losing their religion, and that usually means that this would take place over time. The younger people drop out of church, and eventually they replace the older people, and church attendance has gone way down. Or it could be an aging effect. There's something about being young that keeps you, encourages you not to go to church, and getting older that encourages you to go to church. In other words, it could be social change, or it could be an aging effect. Turns out it's an aging effect. Young people leave home, they go out, and they start sleeping in on Sunday morning. Then they get married. They're more likely to go to church. And they have kids, and they're extremely likely to go to church. And it turns out that this aging effect, if you will, or maturation effect, has been going on for as long as we have data. And yet, every year, somebody comes along and says, oh, the young people aren't going to church. Well, they will go to church. I mean, this has been going on for 50 years that I know of.
Yeah. No, you can even read this in...
get the story every time. And, and the same thing is the people who, quote, don't have any religion.
Mm-hmm.
What they're really telling you is they are not enrolled in a church. They are not telling you that they're irreligious, because all you have to do is take the people... go into those surveys and do a little analysis, and you find that these people who are being claimed as the new atheists and whatnot pray.
Yeah, that's kind of odd thing.
The people who gave their religion as none, well, obviously the 3 or 4% of Americans who are atheists are in that group.
Mm-hmm.
But aside from that, you've got all these people, they pray, they believe in God, they believe in life after death, they just aren't involved in church.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big difference.
Yeah, it's interesting. We can look at survey data on this as well, but the other thing that I found very convincing, especially when it comes to the kids are no longer going to church, is I've heard that for every decade I've been alive, that they're disillusioned with the institutional church. And if you go back to 1900 during the fundamentalist movement, what are the fundamentalists saying? The kids aren't going to church. And in the 1700s, in the 1600s, the Halfway Covenant movement, the kids are not going to church. What are we going to do? The kids never gone to church.
That's right.
Which is kind of interesting on that. Let me, with the few minutes we have here, let me just leave off with, we mentioned at the beginning of the podcast that you are about to publish a new book called America's Blessings, How Religion Benefits Everyone, Including Atheists. United States, from our discussion, seems like it's going to be as religious as it has been in recent decades. There might be little ups and down blips in the data, nothing to necessarily worry about. But the question comes, what's the consequence for American society? And that's what you wrote about here. How does religious benefit everyone, including atheists? If you could just give us a summary of that work that's coming out soon.
Well, for example, let me give you just a few quickies. Atheists are much less likely, living in America than living in Europe, much less likely to, say, be robbed on the way to work or have their homes broken into. Because despite the fact that everybody seems to believe that we have high crime rates, relative to Europe, we have low crime rates. We do have a higher homicide rate, and that's due to any number of things, most which there's no time to go into here. But in terms of robbery and burglary and assault and whatnot, our rates are very low compared to Europe. And that's largely because there's a huge correlation between being religious and not committing crimes. Okay. Well, there are some other things. For example, overwhelmingly, church members are more likely to donate blood. They're much more likely to donate money to secular charities, quite aside from the fact that all the money they give to church. It just kind of, they raise, their kids score better on standardized tests because, of course, they're more likely to be two-parent families, they're more likely to sit on the kids, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Church attenders are even more likely to go to the symphony concerts and to read good books. It goes on and on and on. The divorce rates are lower.
And a lot of different,
fertility rates are higher. It's, there are enormous numbers of benefits that benefit the whole society.
Yeah. Those definitely all have these very positive externalities or positive spillover effects in that, a nation that is more educated is less likely to commit crime, and everybody benefits from that kind of thing. We'll have to have you back on the show to discuss that more in detail, because I'm sure there are people who are listening now saying, no, I can't believe that at all. But we will tell them that within the next month or so, I think it comes out in November, your next book, America's
Right.
Blessings, Religion Benefits Everyone, Including Atheists, will come out. And we'll have you back on the show to discuss that a little bit and fill in other people. But for now, we were able to accomplish the third part of our discussion of the triumph of Christianity. And so, Rod, I want to thank you very much for being on Research on Religion.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.